With Christmas comes the time for a little nostalgia. So I want to read of a Christmas past. No, not from Dickens, but from Dylan Thomas. I'm not good at dialects, so you must excuse me if I fail to bring a Welsh lilt into the following words. Now out of that bright white snowball of Christmas gone comes the stocking of stockings, that hung at the foot of the bed with the arm of a gollywog dangling over the top and small bells ringing in the toes. There was a company, gallant and scarlet, but never nice to taste, though I always tried when very young, of belted and busbied and musketed lead soldiers, so soon to lose their heads and legs in the wars on the kitchen table after the tea things, the mince pies and the cakes that I helped to make by stoning the raisins and eating them, had been cleared away. And a bag of moist and many-coloured jelly babies, and a folded flag and a false nose, and a tram conductor's cap, and a machine that punched tickets and rang a bell. Never a catapult. Once, by a mistake that no one could explain, a little hatchet, and a rubber buffalo, or it may have been a horse, with a yellow head and haphazard legs, and a celluloid duck that made, when you pressed it, a most unduck-like noise, a mewing moo that an ambitious cat might make who wishes to be a cow, and a painting book in which I could make the grass, the trees, the sea, and the animals any colour I pleased, and still the dazzling sky-blue sheep a-grazing in the red field under a flight of rainbow beet and pea-green birds. Christmas morning was always over before you could say Jack Frost. And look, suddenly the pudding was burning. Someone found the silver threepenny bit with a currant on it, and the someone was always Uncle Arnold. The motto in my cracker read, "Let's all have fun this Christmas day. Let's play and sing and shout hooray." And the grown-ups turned their eyes towards the ceiling, and Auntie Bessie, who had already been frightened twice by a clockwork mouse, whimpered at the sideboard and had some elderberry wine. And someone put a glass bowl full of nuts on the littered table, and my uncle said, as he said once every year, "I've got a shoe nut here. Fetch me a shoehorn to open it, boy." And dinner was ended. And I remember that on the afternoon of Christmas Day, when the others sat around the fire and told each other that this was nothing, no, nothing to the great snow-bound and turkey-proud, yule-log crackling, holly-berried, bezidened, and kissing under the mistletoe Christmas when they were children, I would go out, school-capped and gloved and muffled, with my bright new boots squeaking, into the white world, on to the seaward hill, to call on Jim and Dan and Jack, and to walk with them through the silent snowscape of our town. I'm a great lover of John Betjeman's poetry. At Christmas, his poem of the same name has a familiar ring to it, even though again the note of Christmas past is still to be heard. For instance, the reference to the corporation tramcars, though I'm told they may yet be seen again on the streets of our big cities. Christmas. The bells of waiting Advent ring, the tortoise stove is lit again, and lamp oil light across the night has caught the streaks of winter rain in many a stained-glass window sheen from Crimson Lake to Hooker's Green. The holly in the windy hedge, and round the manor house the yew, will soon be stripped to deck the ledge, the altar, font, and arch, and pew, so that the villagers can say, "The church looks nice on Christmas Day." Provincial public houses blaze, and corporation tramcars clang. On lighted tenements I gaze, where paper decorations hang, and bunting in the red town hall says, "Merry Christmas to you all." And London shops on Christmas Eve are strung with silver bells and flowers, as hurrying clerks the city leave to pigeon-haunted classic towers, and marbled clouds go scudding by the many-steepled London sky. And girls in slacks remember Dad, and oafish louts remember Mum, and sleepless children's hearts are glad, and Christmas morning bells say, Come, even to shining ones who dwell safe in the Dorchester Hotel. And is it true? And is it true, this most tremendous tale of all, seen in a stained glass window's hue, a baby in an ox's stall? The maker of the stars and sea become a child on earth for me? And is it true? For if it is, no loving fingers tying strings around those tissued fripperies, the sweet and silly Christmas things, bath salts and inexpensive scent, and hideous ties so kindly meant, no love that in a family dwells, no carolling in frosty air, nor all the steeple-shaking bells can with this single truth compare, that God was man in Palestine and lives today in bread and wine. Now let's listen to one of the great passages of the Old Testament. I'm thinking of the words of a prophet who wrote and spoke to his people who had been carried away captive in one of the many wars in which the people of Israel suffered so much. He saw a day coming when they would be free to live their own life and to worship again in Jerusalem. Comes from Isaiah chapter 40. Comfort ye, comfort ye my people, saith your God. Speak ye comfortably to Jerusalem, and cry unto her that her warfare is accomplished, that her iniquity is pardoned. For she hath received of the Lord's hand double for all her sins. The voice of him that crieth in the wilderness, Prepare ye the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be exalted, and every mountain and hill shall be made low, and the crooked shall be made straight, and the rough places plain. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken it. The voice said, Cry, and he said, What shall I cry? All flesh is grass, and all the godliness thereof is as the flower of the field. The grass withereth, the flower fadeth, because the Spirit of the Lord bloweth upon it. Surely the people is grass. The grass withereth, the flower fadeth. The word of our God shall stand for ever. O Zion that bringest good tidings, get thee up into the high mountain. O Jerusalem that bringest good tidings, lift up thy voice with strength. Lift it up. Be not afraid. Say unto the cities of Judah, Behold your God. Maybe written at about the same time as the passage we have just heard, comes the great shepherd psalm, the 23rd psalm, the psalm for all seasons. In our hymn book there are no less than 14 hymns which reflect in one way or another the sentiments of this psalm. Weddings and funerals often seem incomplete without it. A Chinese Christian at a time of famine rose in the congregation and quoted it, emphasizing the first line. And from a Japanese Christian comes this version. The Lord is my pace-setter, I shall not rush. He makes me stop and rest for quiet intervals. He provides me with images of stillness which restore my serenity. He leads me in the ways of efficiency through calmness of mind, and his guidance is peace. even though I have a great many things to accomplish each day, I will not fret, for his presence is here, his tirelessness, his all-importance will keep me in balance. He prepares refreshment and renewal in the midst of my activity by anointing my mind with his oils of tranquility. Surely harmony and effectiveness shall be the fruits of my hours, for I shall walk in the pace of my Lord and dwell in his house for ever. My cup of worthwhile energy flows. Now let us listen to the original psalm. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil. My cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord for ever. In these restless days, it is good to be reminded of St. Augustine's words, Thou hast made us for thyself, and our hearts are restless until they rest in thee. One of the great poets of the spiritual life was George Herbert. I wonder if his poem, The Pulley, was prompted by Augustine's words. When God at first made man, having a glass of blessings standing by, let us, said he, pour on him all we can. Let the world's riches, which dispersed lie, contract into a span. So strength first made a way, then beauty flowed, then wisdom, honour, pleasure. When almost all was out, God made a stay, perceiving that, alone of all his treasure, rest in the bottom lay. For if I should, said he, bestow this jewel also on my creature, he would adore my gifts instead of me, and rest in nature, not the God of nature. So both should losers be. Yet let him keep the rest, but keep them with repining restlessness. Let him be rich and weary, that at least, if goodness lead him not, yet weariness may toss him to my breast. The secret of rest that God would give us is the rest of his love, his for us and ours for him. The Greeks had more than one word for love, but the New Testament makes one of these uniquely its own. It is the word agape. In the Authorized Version from which we shall read, it is translated charity, which unfortunately in these days has an air of condescension about it, whereas at the time when the Authorized Version came into being, it had all the richness of agape love, a selfless, sacrificial love, the sort of love which St. Paul describes in his first letter to the Corinthians, the love which brought him up short on the Damascus Road and made a new man of him. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, and have not charity, I am become as sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy, and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains, and have not charity, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, and have not charity, it profiteth me nothing. Charity suffereth long, and is kind. Charity envieth not. Charity vaunteth not itself, is not puffed up, doth not behave itself unseemly, seeketh not her own, is not easily provoked, thinketh no evil, rejoiceth not in iniquity, but rejoiceth in the truth, beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, endureth all things. Charity never faileth. But whether there be prophecies, they shall fail. Whether there be tongues, they shall cease. Whether there be knowledge, it shall vanish away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part shall be done away. When I was a child, I spake as a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know even as also I am known. And now abideth faith, hope, charity, these three. But the greatest of these is charity. Just in case you may think I've been too serious, let me share with you a story about heaven. Two mice appeared at the pearly gates, and because they'd been very good mice, St. Peter admitted them without question. Some time later, he met and asked them how they were getting on. "Fine," they said, "but we have one request, if it is possible. We would each like a pair of roller skates." "Yes, of course," said St. Peter. "I will arrange it immediately." Some time later, two cats arrived at the pearly gates, and because they too had had a good record, they were admitted to heaven without question. After a while, Peter met them and asked them if they had any complaints. "Not at all," said they. "Indeed, we were surprised and grateful to get our meals on wheels." The last book of the Bible talks about a new heaven and a new earth. The Revelation of St. John was written at a time when it was extremely dangerous to admit to being a Christian. The aged writer was himself an exile for his faith on an island in the Aegean Sea. It was there that he had a vision in which he saw all that was taking place was part of a universal conflict between good and evil. But with it came the assurance that the Lord God omnipotent reigneth. The book closes as we glimpse with John the time when all things shall become new. "And I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them and be their God. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away. And he that sat upon the throne said, Behold, I make all things new. He said unto me, Write, for these words are true and faithful. And he said unto me, It is done. I am Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give unto him that is athirst at the fountain of the water of life freely. He that overcometh shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son.
In the 50 years of your ministry, and this is a question that I think people would like to ask you, perhaps wouldn't, was your faith ever tested?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It's always being tested. As a padre in a hospital, when one meets some very gravely ill people, not necessarily among the aged, but among the young, the question that's on so many people's lips, why, comes into my mind as well. And while there are various explanations for certain illnesses, there doesn't appear to be any particular explanation for other illnesses. And in that respect, I'm agnostic. But I have a deep sense that somehow all the incongruities of human experience, the pain, the anguish, in other words, the depths of human experience, along with its heights, its joys, its successes, its achievements, is all, as it were, within the overarching providence of God, which has for us all a destiny, which isn't confined to this life alone with all its vicissitudes, but which in the very nature of our creation looks beyond, into what I believe is the life to come and the nearer and the greater presence of God himself. There are times when, in my own experience, through things that have happened in our own family, I have felt very angry with God. And there are times when I sometimes say in my prayers, I don't know what you're up to. I can't understand it. But I'm able to talk to God like that because I believe he's there. Mm-hmm. And I believe that although I don't understand, he's still in control. As that reading that we read, that we took from the Revelation of St. John, I believe with all my heart that the Lord God omnipotent reigns.
We're making this recording as part of the celebration of the centenary of Haddenham, the Haddenham Methodist Church. What do you think? Do you think it will survive another 100 years? What do you look into the future? If you could look into the future, what do you expect to find? What would you like to find? Perhaps there's a different question.
I'd like to feel that the witness of the Haddenham Methodist Church today, at the end of its 100 years, will be such that although the Methodist Church, as we understand it at this moment in time, may be totally different in 100 years' time from what it is today, it will nonetheless have made its contribution to the ongoing witness to Christ in the village. That may sound a little bit confused, but at the back of my mind is the conviction that increasingly, as the years pass, Christians are learning a bit more sense. And we're learning that our divisions are far less important than the things that we have in common. And I would like to feel that the Methodist Church in Haddenham will certainly continue for X number of years, but I would like to feel that it will be increasingly making its contribution toward the church and its witness in Haddenham, which is greater than any particular denominational emphasis, and which speaks of a unity which is something that only the Spirit of God finally can achieve.
Well, may I thank you on behalf of people listening to this recording for giving us your time and for reading these passages to us and for telling us about your life. And we hope that this recording will give people continued pleasure. Fred Clifford, may I thank you very much.
Glad to be with you, Paul, and thank you.